And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Summer is here, and just about the time it gets going, the days start getting shorter, which is the best incentive yet to get out and enjoy the good times. Meanwhile, in the nation's capital, the Senate is trying to put together their side of a national energy bill. We find out how they're doing and visit Petrified Forest National Park on your Voice of the Earth when we return here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What a time to be debating a supposed comprehensive energy bill in the Senate, a few days after the longest day of sunlight of the year has passed. Because when you look at this new emerging plan being forged in the nation's capital, it's pretty obvious this is Senator Domenici's dream piece. It is such an old energy giveaway, it's almost embarrassing. We're dedicating this Wildside News show to the National Energy Bill, which will include a giant new provision to inventory all U.S. continental waters for possible energy development, despite the moratorium on such and the objections by citizens and governors in coastal states. The inventory uses high-energy sonic explosions, which verge on immoral acts to life of our oceans. In segment 3, we take a break and visit a terrific national park where the ancient life that didn't turn into coal and oil managed to survive intact as solid rock. It's our Petrified Forest National Park in Arizona. It's another great show that gives you the information you need when you want it from anywhere in the world on your Voice of the Earth, the Wildside News. So let's take a look at today's news and then go take a look at the nation's developing energy bill. So first, the news. The Senate continues debate on its energy bill, which is scheduled to make available $14 billion to promote more domestic oil, natural gas, and gasoline production, make the U.S. electric grid more reliable, and build more nuclear power plants. As well, alternative energy or clean energy sources are being provided with incentives for mixing their contribution to the energy equation. As the debate continues, President Bush visited the site Wednesday of a proposed future Calvert Cliffs nuclear power plant south of Washington, D.C., as part of an effort to rejuvenate the nuclear power industry that has laid dormant for over 20 years. The president championed the safety and global warming sensitivity of the nuclear industry. Nuclear power accounts for 20% of all U.S. electric power generation. Citing improved training and technological advances, the president offered, "Nuclear power plants are far safer than ever before, generating electricity and protecting the environment at the same time." This national energy bill will be covered in more detail following the news. The Bush administration is using the science of numbers to alter various standards enacted by various regulatory agencies, which mandated repopulation strategies when fish species were considered overfished. Whereas in the past, overfished species were required to be rebuilt within 10 years, the new proposals create flexible time frames that will extend the number of years that impacted fish can remain at risk. The National Environmental Trust said that if approved, the rule would open the nation's oceans to overfishing with impunity and strip the ability to protect the nation's fish populations and the ocean ecosystems of which they are a part. Meanwhile, in South Korea, the International Whaling Commission Wednesday urged Japan to stop using whale research as a cover for what in reality is commercial fishing. Japan, under the auspices of data collection, harvests 450 minke whales and also kills fin and humpback whales, two species considered threatened by conservationists, claiming their take is a scientific taking for collecting data on the whale's eating habits. Through this program, which is not regulated by the IWC, Japan intends to extend its research to double its previous levels. In most cases, the meat from the research animals ends up in gourmet food shops in Japan and in specialty restaurants. Japan has threatened to pull out of the IWC, as they claim the scientific underpinnings are real and the rancor around the program overblown. Meanwhile, in California, following the declaration that West Coast groundfish fishery was an economic disaster due to a combination of overfishing and poor ocean conditions, the Pacific Fishery Management Council, which regulates West Coast fishing, supported a ban on bottom trawling in depths beyond 4,200 feet and a variety of shallower areas, extending to all western states' coastal waters from 3 miles to 200 miles offshore. "It's a huge victory for conservation," said Jim Ayers, Pacific Region Director for Oceana. "It maintains economic opportunity for today's commercial fishermen, but more importantly, it ensures economic opportunity for future generations." And now a note on other fishing issues. With Father's Day behind us, researchers have released a report on the worst fish dads. According to behavioral scientists, fish just don't really make good dads. However, the Japanese cardinal fish has set a new record low in the annals of parenting. The father of the brood starts out being an amazingly dedicated dad who raises his young in his mouth until they are able to get along on their own. That is, until he meets a female that he feels is more deserving of his charms than the mother of his children. It's then that he eats his children and then rushes off to fan the flames of love with his new romance. And that's today's news. And so now, our story in progress. About a year ago, I remember doing a story in which I talked about rumors of a barrel of oil rising from the then current $30 per barrel to $50 a barrel, and even talk of $70 a barrel. Well, welcome to the new world. This week, oil touched $60 per barrel. Yesterday, it was stuck around $59, and there's no reason for that price to get any lower in the near future. As a matter of fact, with Norwegian oil workers threatening to strike and other unsettling news and uncertainties, we can now announce that experts are casually slipping predictions of $100 per barrel oil as a fairly reasonable futures price. I have no choice but to warn us all. When that happens, significant changes in our social structure will be sudden and dramatic. When such oil prices occur, and with every creeping $10 rise in the price of oil, prices on all goods and services will have to rise as well. Another doubling in the cost of oil will see prices at the pump reaching $4 to $5 a gallon. A typical SUV with a 20-gallon tank will require close to $100 to fill the tank, which may buy conservatively 3 days of transportation. For people on minimum wage, it will get to the point that they are working for $1.50 an hour after paying for gas to get to and from work, which would leave about $200 per month to live on. That's for food, housing, fun, and everything else. And through all this, I watch our grand pooba of economic forecasting, Alan Greenspan, go on and on with his deadpan drolling, as members of Congress smile intelligently and repeat academic questions as if in Economics 5004. Shouldn't someone sound an alarm? Energy these days. The effects of this uncertain necessity go unchecked. So at a time like this, as the Senate debates and crafts our energy bill, our national energy bill, are they addressing these critical needs of this nation? Let's take a look. First, crafting a national energy bill has been attempted before. In 2003, the effort stalled because there was significant disagreement over the gasoline additive NTBE. So this year, although the House has passed an energy bill. The Senate is now amending its version with many new amendments that the House may not agree to. If the two bodies cannot come to agreement, there will be no energy bill. The first logical question most people would ask is, will this help us reduce the price of gas and home heating oil? The answer is no. There is absolutely nothing in this bill that addresses the immediate looming crisis. Okay, then one might logically ask, does this bill lead to a reasonably efficient answer to our reliance on foreign energy sources in the future? Again, the answer is no. As a matter of fact, it does plenty to create more divisions within our people over energy production by providing massive incentives to further expansion of oil, natural gas, and coal within the U.S. while providing minimal support for the development of a real energy sustainable future. And to further complicate the picture, there is a lot of bobbing and weaving to clear the way for the new emerging good guy for our energy future, nuclear power. That's right, radiation is a clean tech option because it is friendly to CO2 emissions. It's really just that simple. And the energy bill is bringing billions of dollars to the coal industry because it has new technologies that promise fewer sulfur emissions. Of course, little is said about the requirements to tear up massive landscapes, mostly on public lands, to get to this coal and uranium ore. That, of course, is a minor detail. I really don't have time to listen to all of the day's testimony ongoing in the Senate. The debate runs strongly along partisan lines, even though the two senators from New Mexico are jointly sponsoring this bill, Pete Domenici, a Republican, and Jeff Bingaman, a Democrat. This is supposed to give the appearance that this is a good-faith, bipartisan attempt at compromise. But the debate is as partisan as ever. I tune in on occasion to hear some new amendment being proposed, and the rhetoric is as it has always been. Republicans promote extractive industries like coal, oil, gas, and uranium, while the Democrats fight for wind, solar, geothermal oceans, fuel cells, and the like. But with the balance of power being what it is in the Senate, it's pretty obvious which side wins almost every issue. I get embarrassed listening to the Republican side still quoting experts and amazingly still quoting the distorted rewriting of science to stall any admission by the Senate that global warming is in fact a threat or even a real consideration. The highly touted McCain-Lieberman amendment that would have placed mandated controls on CO2 emissions and brought us in line with other developed nations was rejected and replaced with the Hagel amendment, which encourages voluntary compliance to lessen global warming. I guess that is the environmental victory we are all now supposed to rejoice about. At least there is acknowledgement that global warming can be mentioned in legislation bearing bipartisan support. Oh, yippee. At times, it becomes a carnival of mirrors. Wednesday afternoon, I tuned in to find a cadre of three Republican senators discussing the Alexander Warner Amendment that proposed placing restrictions on federal funding for any wind power projects that were within 20 miles of the boundary of any highly scenic areas, which included all UN heritage sites, all national parks, all national lakeshores, all national seashores, all national wildlife refuges, and the list went on. Here was Lamar Alexander making the case that our nation's scenic areas are so precious that a federal law had to be put in place to prohibit any wind power projects from receiving federal subsidies if they were within 20 miles of any of these areas. Wow. This by the same people who fight tooth and nail to site massive oil production facilities within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and who only recently ridiculed those who appealed for protection of this majestic treasure? The large-scale, blatant hypocrisy by the extractive powerhouses To propose such an amendment designed to kill the wind industry is appalling. On a very personal note, I simply must say that as someone who lived for 25 years in New Mexico and who has watched the history of both of New Mexico's two senators, it has been obvious that there are very few senators as deeply owned by the extractive energy players than Pete Domenici. And Senator Bingaman, a good scientist, lacks the spit and vinegar required to claw out the support needed to assure our energy future. It is frightening to realize that America's survival has been placed in the pocket of this lifelong servant of special interests, Senator Pete Domenici. As I write this, the vote is being taken on the Alexander Amendment. I believe it speaks directly to the unfettered gall and hypocrisy which is guiding the supposed energy bill. There's much to be said about legislating America's energy future with this bill. At this point, it appears that we have dramatically lost this battle to develop a sustainable energy future, to recreate our dreams, put people back to work, and develop the clean tech future that is critical to our national survival. The supposed bipartisan image which has been crafted is a dangerous appeasement to what should be and could be a real effort by our elected officials to put us on a path to true energy independence. As things go, the Senate bill, although acknowledging the importance of a mix of old and new energy sources, falls so short as to be laughable. Perhaps the best option for us at this point is to hope that this bill follows in the history of previous energy bills, and that it will die for lack of compromise in the House. I urge you all to use your best judgment, do the necessary, and work to give power back to the citizens of this country. When we return, we talk with Lisa Speer of the NRDC, who takes a look at the energy bill's provision, which passed, which, if implemented, will create one of the most appalling attacks on our living oceans, all in a backdoor attempt to expand oil and gas exploration on our continental shelf, as we continue to look at the ongoing Senate energy debate on Your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
One provision of the Senate energy bill has the potential to damage more living creatures than any other single effort in the history of humankind. It's all part of the ongoing quest for oil and gas, and it's passed in the Senate. It sounds so nice, the Ocean Resources Inventory. But this effort may be the most flagrant violation of our dominance over the creatures on this earth ever. And it just slipped its way into America's new national energy bill. Is it science or something worse? We find out when we return on Your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News. The Senate's National Energy Bill, now under consideration, being managed in the Senate by two New Mexico senators, Domenici and Bingaman. Let's be honest. Domenici has served the major energy companies most all of his life, and his seniority gives him an inordinate amount of power in the Senate. The big winners in the Senate bill are specifically nuclear power, which has been reborn under his guidance, coal, and the oil industry. There has finally been acknowledgement of alternative energy as a player, albeit ever so minor, but at least discussed. But a rather unique provision of the bill, which seemed to come out of nowhere, was the request for yet another energy resource survey.
Joining us now from Washington, D.C. to discuss the survey is Lisa Speer, an oceans expert from the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. Lisa, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lisa, let's start out by letting people know what the NRDC is.
The Natural Resources Defense Council is an environmental organization dedicated to protecting the environment and public health. We have almost 1 million members and supporters, and we use our various staff and membership resources to promote environmentally sound solutions to the nation's environmental problems.
I've been following the energy legislation that's being discussed in the Senate right now. Hopefully this country can eventually get around to some sort of energy policy, preferably one that actually leads to resolutions of our energy crisis in an environmentally sound and sustainable way. I'm not so sure that that's where we're headed exactly, but at least we're making some progress. But one of the aspects that came out that kind of took me by surprise was something called the OCS. And you actually have a familiarity with the OCS. Why don't you give us a background on that?
The OCS stands for the Outer Continental Shelf. This is the region of the U.S. that extends from 3 miles offshore out to 200 miles offshore. This area, which is larger actually than the onshore area of the United States, is managed by the United States for its resources. One of the big debates with respect to how we use the Outer Continental Shelf has been related to the development of oil and gas in those areas. The Outer Continental Shelf around the country does contain oil and gas resources. These are federal lands, and so that oil and gas is federal oil and gas. And the question is, how much of this do we want to develop? Where do we want it developed? What are the environmental impacts of developing that oil and gas, and how are we to make a decision as a nation about the appropriate use of offshore land?
There are certainly positives in the sense that we are able to draw upon those energy resources to help resolve our energy crisis, but as well there's other environmental considerations, and for that reason there actually has been a moratorium in place for quite some time in most of the continental shelf areas of the United States.
That's correct. There has been a substantial debate about how to proceed over oil and gas development offshore, and many states have said that they do not want to see the federal land that lies 3 miles off their coast developed for oil and gas because those states have a very strong and significant interest in protecting their coastal and ocean resources from the effects of oil and gas development. As a result, states banded together in the 1980s to object to a plan by then Secretary of the Interior James Watt to open the entire Outer Continental Shelf throughout the entire country to oil and gas development. States like California, Massachusetts, Florida, and others got together and essentially objected to that, and through their congressional representatives obtained a moratorium that has been in place now for more than 20 years, and that moratorium prohibits the Interior Department, which is the arm of the U.S. government responsible for managing the Outer Continental Shelf, from offering for lease or conducting activities related to oil and gas off the coasts of the moratorium states. The Senate bill contains a provision that requires the Interior Department to inventory the Outer Continental Shelf, and there was an amendment to strike that provision offered by Senators Nelson and Martinez from Florida and supported by senators from coastal states around the country. Unfortunately, that amendment failed, and the provision in the Senate bill remains. On the House side, there is no similar provision, and so when the House and Senate meet together in what they call conference, they will have to work out differences between the two bills, and this inventory is one of those differences. The outcome of the conference will determine whether, in fact, this inventory of Outer Continental Shelf resources proceeds.
Let's talk about what this provision actually is going to involve. It's called an inventory, and as you, I read somewhere, you said, well, this isn't really something that happens on paper. As a matter of fact, that is the issue. This resource inventory is quite a very complex and very controversial action. What actually is involved?
Well, there are two parts to the controversy. The first has to do with the impacts of the inventory itself, and the second has to do with the whole concept of the camel's nose under the tent.
Yeah.
That meaning that if we go out and inventory the Outer Continental Shelf off of areas where the coastal states have objected to OCS development, the concern is that the next step will be an attempt to try to open those areas to oil and gas development. But let me address the first issue first. The bill requires the Secretary of the Interior to conduct an inventory and analysis of oil and natural gas resources beneath all of the waters of the Outer Continental Shelf. The inventory must use any available technology except drilling, but including 3D seismic technology in order to obtain accurate resource estimates. The process of collecting 3D seismic information involves towing an air gun array behind a vessel, and the air gun array fires very loud sound. This is some of the loudest sound produced by humans.
Someone suggested it's comparable to an artillery shell, for example.
They're extremely, extremely loud. And the sounds bounce off the seabed formations and are read by a computer on the vessel. And that essentially allows the vessel to map the seabed and the geologic formations beneath it. Unfortunately, these very loud sounds are taking place in an environment where most of the living creatures rely on sound to live. So marine mammals, fish, all require a sound, an environment where they can communicate with each other. And these massive air gun explosions have been associated with significant effects on both whales as well as dolphins and fish populations. So the concern is that we're going to be inventorying the entire continental shelf. That could involve millions of these types of explosions and potentially create a noise environment that spans from Alaska to Florida that could have very significant effects, both individually as well as cumulatively, on our marine mammals that are so important to this country, and many of which are endangered, and our fish populations, which are critically important to the states. So those are some of the concerns with respect to the inventory. Once the inventory is conducted, then the Interior Department will analyze the results. And the second sort of suite of issues then emerges, which is, okay, then what do you do? Do you open these areas up? Do you keep them closed? How do we want to proceed as a nation? Our view is that we ought not to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars as a country to inventory areas that states don't want to see development take place in. It doesn't make sense to spend that kind of money if you're not going to actually open those areas up and develop them. And so, in our view, this is a misbegotten idea. It does not advance the nation's energy security, and it's simply a waste of taxpayer dollars.
There's no doubt that if then they will undoubtedly uncover areas that have recoverable resources, that once that becomes public knowledge, the debate will begin. It'll be like creating a whole series of new ANWR crises along our coastal areas. That's a tough side of this, is the fact that it's just going to create a lot of controversy in this country and possibly not even lead to that much real resource development. Let's get back a little bit to what's involved, because here to paint a picture, since this is a radio show, the entire coast, from, as you say, from Alaska down to California, and then from Maine all the way down to the tip of Florida, and then on the inner coastal areas, except for the deep south and Louisiana and Mississippi and areas like that, will be subjected to this. On the entire area will be mapped, and these boats tow these arrays of air guns, and they're exploding about every 6 to 10 seconds, so that virtually the entire coastal area will be impacted through time by this survey, every single square inch, if they're going to be effective.
If they do, in fact, survey the entire outer continental shelf, as the bill requires, then, in fact, there will be this incredibly intense and sort of universal sound environment that marine animals are going to have to deal with. And remember that marine mammals and fish need to use sound to communicate with each other, to find mates, to locate their young, to find food. So when you disrupt that environment, that sound environment in the ocean, you're potentially disrupting a whole set of activities that are essential for the survival of these animals. You raised a very good point earlier on, which is that when they inventory these areas, there may not, in fact, be a huge amount of oil and gas in the areas that are currently closed. And that's, in fact, what the Interior Department now estimates. If you look at their most recent estimates of oil and gas on the Outer Continental Shelf, they, which were just issued in December, 5 months ago, they think that most of the oil and gas, something around the proximity of 80% of the oil and gas that lies under the U.S. Outer Continental Shelf, is located in areas already available for leasing. So why are we spending this huge amount of money to inventory the moratorium areas when most of the oil and gas, by the government's own calculations, is already available to the industry? This is something that just strikes many of us as a very ill-begotten idea.
Any idea really what's behind that? Is it just someone's going to get a big contract? Or I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
Well, I think part of it is that the industry is looking for, as appropriate, to make the most profit that it can. And many of it may be that the resources that may lie in the moratorium areas are more profitable to extract. But at a time when the oil and gas industry is enjoying record profits, it doesn't seem to us to be a valid reason to open up the Outer Continental Shelf to oil and gas exploration just to line the pockets of already rich oil and gas companies.
Do we know who would actually pay for this? In other words, this would be, in essence, if it were funded by the government, then this would be an effective subsidy. Not that subsidies are all that bad, but the oil and gas industry already receives tremendous subsidies. Who's paying for this?
Well, that's a very good question. And the Senator Nelson on the Senate floor yesterday in his statement when this issue was being debated noted that this inventory could cost upwards of $1 billion. Now, that is taxpayer money, presumably, if the government puts the bill, which it will. And the question then becomes, well, don't we have better uses for $1 billion than to essentially make it easier for the oil companies to make a larger profit? This just doesn't strike us as the best use of taxpayer dollars. And in addition, I think there's a lot of concern on the side of Democrats and Republicans about sort of what the long-term implications are of this type of activity. As you probably know, this is offshore oil and gas is an issue that crosses political lines and has been in protection for coastal areas from offshore development has been supported by people of all types of political stripes and up and down levels of government, from, you know, governors right on down to local chambers of commerce and others. And this sort of bipartisan nature of the opposition really sends a signal that you know, the government's not going to be able to drill there. It's not going to, they're not going to be able to get any money back for the taxpayer that would offset the, you know, $1 billion that this might cost if in fact it goes forward. So there's a lot of revenue and taxpayer issues that I think haven't really been thoroughly examined by the Congress. Senator Martinez, who sponsored the amendment, is a Republican, and Senator Dole from North Carolina made a very eloquent statement against, you know, in support of this amendment that would have struck the inventory out of the energy bill. Republicans from all over the country have repeatedly and often objected to offshore oil and gas, including right up into the president's own brother, Governor Jeb Bush of Florida.
Because it has tremendous economic impact if there should be problems, if the coastal areas should be impacted by drilling rigs or spills.
That's exactly right. Most coastal states derive a significant portion of their economic viability from coastal tourism and fishing. And oil and gas development is fundamentally inconsistent with both of those.
One of the things I wish we had time to get into, but we won't today, and that is the fact that in terms of the effect on the ocean species, we really don't know. I mean, the fact that we know what may happen to whales or dolphins or porpoises or other large species of fish and mammals is important, but we have no idea scientifically really the impact that there could be long-term on who knows how many different species, because we just don't know. In other words, these huge sonic booms can literally rupture hearing membranes and systems within animals, and we don't know the impact already on our challenged oceans that may have.
That's exactly right, and there's a growing awareness and concern in the scientific community about the noise level in the oceans and cumulatively what that noise from everything from sonar to ship noise to oil and gas exploration. There's just many different sources of noise in the ocean, and animals have not been able to evolve fast enough to deal with them. And so, you know, there's some real, very serious questions about how we are affecting the animals that live in the ocean. And, you know, when people remember that, in fact, life in the ocean is essential for us, both on many levels, both for food as well as for other benefits. We are playing with fire when we don't really think about and evaluate the potential effects of such a massive undertaking as the one the Senate has just proposed that we do.
Lisa Spear is with the NRDC, and we're going to wrap this up in just a minute here. I'd like to know, this has been passed. I know it has been okayed. It received a positive response, this provision in the energy bill. What do you think is going to happen, and what is the NRDC suggesting that people do who are concerned?
You're correct that the inventory was passed and was accepted by the Senate. However, there is no similar provision in the House energy bill, and when the Senate and the House meet together to iron out the differences between the two bills, that will be the opportunity for us to try to remove the inventory from the final bill that emerges from Congress. And so people who are concerned about this inventory need to let their congressmen and senators know of their concern and their opposition to any provision in an energy bill that comes out of the Congress that would permit a massive inventory of oil and gas resources on the Outer Continental Shelf from taking place. Calls and letters are the single most effective ways of communicating to politicians that this is just not acceptable, and we urge people to make their views known as quickly and as urgently as possible.
And it's important that actually this be on both sides of Congress, both the House and the Senate, because there's two sides to the future of this progressing.
That's correct.
Lisa Spear, we're going to follow this, and if people want to learn more about the NRDC and track your efforts in this, what's the best way for them to do so?
The best way is to go to nrdc.org. Our website has lots of information about a whole variety of environmental issues, and we love to have people visit us. So thanks so much for having me on the show, Sydney.
It's been absolutely my pleasure, and I hope we have a chance to talk again about these issues. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Wild Side News.
Okay, and now back to the real world of people and places and our natural treasury as we head out to Arizona for a visit with a park which celebrates the Triassic life of good old planet Earth, when we continue with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the Senate seeks ways to tap into energy locked into the ancient forests and landscapes that through time morphed into vast pockets of oil and natural gas, we look at another remnant of the ancient forests locked as rock in one of America's national parks. We head on out to Arizona and its petrified forests when we return here on the Wild Side News. Nature works in mysterious ways, and when ancient trees fall and get preserved for us to see and admire now, it provides some spectacular continuity with the wonders of the world.
Now we're talking with Lynn Carranza, who is the Chief of Interpretation at Petrified Forest National Park. And Lynn, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Well, happy to be here.
Yeah, great. Petrified Forest National Park is, I've been through that area. I haven't been to the park itself. Let's first of all let our listeners know where the park is located.
Well, we are located just east of Holbrook, Arizona on Interstate 40 at exit 311. So we're right on a main interstate, easy to find, and very easy to get into the park.
The park is actually a pretty good sized park.
It is. It's over 90,000 acres currently, and we just had a boundary expansion, and with the new authorized boundary, we more than double that size as the National Park Service is able to acquire those lands within the new authorized boundary.
Well, of course, Petrified Forest National Park features this extraordinary historic collection of, well, why don't you actually tell us what it is that people will find when they come to your park.
Initially, Petrified Forest National Park was set aside to preserve the petrified wood, which was fascinating to people because here were these huge trees. Clearly these things were trees, but they were stone. But everyone could see that these giant things lying on the ground were at one time trees. So initially, the park was established as a national monument in 1906 to preserve the petrified wood. Over time, the park has expanded and included areas of great scenic beauty like the Painted Desert. And so there's a little bit of something for everybody in the park now. The park actually achieved national park status in 1962. The park preserves areas of not only the late Triassic paleontology, which is so fascinating, which includes the petrified wood and fossils of very interesting creatures that lived during the late Triassic, but the park also includes wonderful archaeological sites, ancestral Pueblo sites. We have some of the most wonderful petroglyphs in the world. We have scenic beauty. We have wilderness area that someone visiting the park could experience, wonderful vistas, and we're preserving a recovering remnant of short grass prairie in Arizona. So there's a little something for everybody here.
That really is quite an extraordinary panoply of opportunities. Let's talk about these trees, how they came to be, and then also when people come, what they're really going to experience in terms of seeing these ancient living things.
This area during the late Triassic was very different from what a visitor would experience today.
And help our listeners understand what that means, the late Triassic.
The late Triassic was 225 million years ago. It was just prior to the Jurassic, which many people are familiar with. Some of the fossils that are preserved in the layers of rock here are very strange crocodile-like creatures and amphibians and reptiles, and we are sort of the dawn of the dinosaur period during mm-hmm. the late Triassic.
Mm-hmm.
So while we do have some early dinosaurs appearing in these rock layers, for the most part we're pre-dinosaur.
Very interesting. Now, tell us what the environment would have been like then. What types of trees were these that make up the dominant forest that is now preserved in the park?
Well, these were evergreen trees, and very tall, probably 200 feet tall.
Wow.
The whole area was much wetter. It was much swampier. Of course, during the late Triassic, the Earth, all of the continents were together as one, called Pangaea. And this area here was located closer to the equator. So the climate was different. It was very wet, very humid. Large rivers flowed through here. And it was because of all the moisture and because of these large rivers that we had all of the conditions that allowed for the trees in certain areas to become petrified.
How does a tree become petrified? Because certainly not all trees have become petrified.
Right. Some of the trees, probably during flood conditions, were carried downstream. They became buried under sediments, and they were decomposing because of the moisture and some volcanic ash. They were decomposing without the benefit of a lot of oxygen. And so what was happening is silica in the water had a chance to replace some of the organic material in the tree. And so as this process continued, the trees then became stone, or they became petrified. So they're mostly silica. They're quartz. And you can actually see crystals within these logs.
Was this like a forest? Was it literally a forest of trees, or were there more occasional trees? What's your vision of what this may have been like?
It was probably a forest with grasslands interspersed. I shouldn't even say grasslands, because at that time, during the late Triassic, there were no flowering plants at that time. So
wow.
Some interesting reed-type plants
mm-hmm.
and horsetails and very interesting plants growing mm-hmm. here at that time, too.
So you have samples of those types of plants that are fossilized as well?
Absolutely. Our visitor center at the south end of the park, called Rainbow Forest Museum, has exhibits of fossils, leaf fossils, cone fossils, along with the petrified wood and some of the animals that were found in the late Triassic.
So, for example, a person visiting could get a pretty good idea of what the diversity of life may have been like at that time.
Absolutely.
Now, you talked about trees being 200 feet tall. Can you actually see trees that represent that height in terms of the fossils?
Well, most of the petrified logs are just the trunks, just the lower trunks, the largest part of the tree. However, we have an area, a trail that visitors could walk called Long Logs Trail, where some of the longest fossilized trees can be seen.
Hmm. Are you involved in the process of trying to discover more of these trees underground?
Actually, we don't have to dig to find these. They're exposed through erosion pretty regularly here. Erosion takes place every time it rains. Mm. The soils here are soft clays, and so fossils are regularly being exposed. We do have a paleontologist in the park, and we do have a number of researchers that study the park. We are finding an estimated 4 new species from the late Triassic every year.
Wow.
So research, science and research are big topics in this park, and we host a number of researchers.
Now, some of these trees really got pretty, very big at the base. Some of the diameters of these get to be quite extraordinary.
Yes. Maybe not like a redwood tree today or a sequoia, but they were large trees.
I mean, like 6 feet, 5 feet, something in diameter?
Probably more like 4
okay.
feet.
Now, they're also beautiful. One of the things about the petrified wood, of course, is the fact that you can actually, in many cases, discern the various rings and bark and things, so people can really see what these trees looked like.
I think the thing that makes our because petrified wood is found all over the world. It's found in every state in this country. It's very, very common here, but I think what really sets the petrified wood of northeastern Arizona apart is that it's colorful, and that's because of the quartz crystals that took the place of the organic material. We have some of the most colorful petrified wood in the world. We have very well-preserved trees. You can tell that it's a tree. You know, some petrified wood in some areas you can't always tell. You know, it would take a scientific eye to really determine what that stone was. But here it's clear to just about everybody who visits.
Now you have an interpretive center.
At the north end of the park, the Painted Desert Visitor Center. We have a visitor center at the south end of the park, which is the Rainbow Forest Museum. And we also have a visitor contact area at the Painted Desert Inn, which is a historic landmark.
People who come to the visitor center, what types of things will they be able to see there?
Well, it depends on which visitor center they come to.
Mm-hmm.
At the south end, the emphasis is on the paleontology of the park. That's where people can experience the late Triassic. They can do a virtual tour of the Triassic there. They can watch the film about the park there. They can see plant fossils and animal fossils on exhibit there. At the north end of the park, we serve more as an orientation and information center, since that is right off of the interstate. We are also at the jumping off place to our wilderness, so at that end of the park, we focus more on the scenic beauty, the badlands, which we call Painted Desert.
People drive to this park because it is somewhat remote. What's the experience going to be like?
The park road is 28 miles in length from the north end to the south end of the park. Along the way, at the north end, there are several viewpoints of the Painted Desert, and the Painted Desert Inn, National Historic Landmark, is up there in the north end. Visitors can experience the beautiful rolling hills of the Painted Desert, the pink and red and wonderful colors of the Chinle Formation there. And they can also take the trail into wilderness. Now, we do allow camping in our wilderness areas. It is not a developed campground. There's no RV camping, for example. But it is the access area into the wilderness where people can do some wilderness camping. And then if you continue down the road heading south, Newspaper Rock and Puerco Pueblo are our premier archaeological sites where visitors can experience the petroglyphs, which to me are unequaled. They're just, this area is wonderful. It's wonderfully rich in petroglyphs.
And for people who may not know what a petroglyph is.
A petroglyph is a design that's been pecked into the rock. And we have a wonderful array of different designs animal designs, Kachina designs, human designs, textile designs even pecked into the rocks, geometric designs. And we have a number of solar calendars. The people who lived here were agricultural, and so they needed to know when the right time would be to plant their crops and harvest their crops. And so we find a number of solar calendars. And in fact, in June, in early June, every year we do solar calendar programs at Puerco Pueblo.
Now describe a solar calendar. That sounds interesting.
It's a spiral that's been pecked into the rock, and as the sun rises in the morning, it shines through a crack between two rocks, and a dagger of light then moves down towards the center of the petroglyph, the center of the spiral, and that marks the summer solstice.
Now, of course, this is a system that was used throughout the cultures at that time. For example, obviously this would suggest that there was a definite communication between the people in Petrified National Park and the Chaco Canyon people, who had very similar kinds of sundials.
There was definite communication going on between the different peoples of the Southwest and into Mexico and over to the coast. And we know this because of the trade items that are found. We believe this area of, that is petrified forest was significant because of the petrified wood. Petrified wood would be a great trade item because from the petrified wood you can make tools, arrow points, and so this was the main trade item that these people living here had. And we know that these people traded for pottery. They traded for shells from the coast.
How far do you find the petrified wood reaching out into the cultures around?
Petrified wood, as I said, has been found all over the country. There are people who are still using petrified wood today. It's still significant to them. The Hopi, just north of us, for example, have ties to the archaeological sites found here in the park. And petrified wood is used by them ceremonially. So petrified wood is important to many cultures even today.
You also talk about the natural beauty of the park. Now, a lot of people think of Arizona as a pretty hot, you know, it is hot, but also not necessarily a spectacular area for vistas and things, and yet, quite honestly, there are extraordinary vistas in various areas of Arizona.
Absolutely. The geology is such that we get interesting features like mesas and buttes. The color of the landscape really sets it apart, with the pink and the red hills of the Painted Desert in the north, and then the blue and gray hills of the Badlands near Blue Mesa. There's quite the scenery here. I think one of the appealing things about Petrified Forest National Park is that many of the vistas and many of the features of the park are outside the experience of most Americans. They're oddities, and we have so many strange things, from the creatures that were found from the late Triassic to our strange landscapes. So it's well worth the trip. It's something that most people remember. It's a dramatic landscape and can be very inspiring.
Now, what are the best seasons to visit the park?
Well, I think any time of year is good in this area. We have, for the most part, good weather. It is hot in Arizona, you're right, but we are in the northeast corner of the state. We're a little over 5,000 feet in elevation. So compared to the big metropolitan areas like Phoenix, we are quite a bit cooler here. And in fact, a lot of people from the Phoenix area will visit to escape the heat in the summer. In the winter, we can get snow here. The Painted Desert is beautiful in the snow, well worth a trip just to see it in the snow. We don't normally have such severe winter conditions that it keeps people from traveling. Winter's a great time. A lot of people visit us in the fall, and you'll find the spring is great because of the wildflowers, although spring is usually a little bit windy.
You're a terrific spokesperson for this park. It seems to me that you have a personal love affair with this place.
Absolutely.
What personally is it that about the park that most affects you?
I love the wide open space. I love to stand at one of our viewpoints and see almost forever. I can stand at Potato Point and I can see the mountains near Flagstaff from here, almost 100 miles away. We have clean air, we have clear skies most of the time, we have good weather most of the time, wide open spaces, wonderful wildlife experiences on the short grass prairie, interesting landscapes, a wonderful paleontological record for science. So it's the whole package makes it worth being here for me.
Lynn Carranza, who we're talking with, who is the chief of interpretation. How long have you been at Petrified Forest National Park?
I've been here a little over 2 years.
Well, you've really, really connected with this place.
Yes, I have.
Was it a choice? Did you come there by choice?
Or I came here by choice.
Mm-hmm. Where had you been before?
The park that I'd been previous to Petrified Forest was Redwood National Park.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
On the coast. I've also worked at Carlsbad Caverns
uh-huh.
National Park,
mm-hmm.
Guadalupe Mountains National Park in Texas, Montezuma Castle National Monument, also in Arizona, and White Sands National Monument.
That's quite a legacy. But you are definitely, something is moving you about this park, I can tell. You really do enjoy it. Are you a bit of an artist or a photographer or something?
I guess I could say I'm a little bit of an artist, yes.
Okay, because you really do have a vision of this place, and you're very moved by that, and that comes across in everything you say. If people want to find out more information, what's the best way to do so?
Well, we have a good website at www.nps.gov/PEFO.
For Petrified Forest.
Petrified Forest.
Mm-hmm.
And there we have an in-depth section where a visitor could read about all of the different aspects of the park before they visit. We also have a section on there about planning your visit that will give you information that would help you if you're heading out this way. So I would start there, and then if you have any further questions, call the park for information. The number is 928-524-6228.
Lynn Carranza, Chief of Interpretation at Petrified Forest National Park. I want to thank you so much for sharing your spirit and your real love of with this park and the national parks on the Wild Side News.
It was my pleasure.
As this show is being produced, the Senate continues to debate our energy future. As I finish the show, I am happy to announce that the Alexander Amendment to prohibit wind power within 20 miles of highly scenic areas has been defeated, 32-67. We must truly begin to pay attention, to get active, to take a stand for our future, for those to whom we have entrusted our future are dealing out cards and making bets on our future. This deck is marked, and there's too many jokers to play the game fairly. The game needs to change. Do what you can. This is Sidney Wildsmith, your host and producer. I thank each of you for tuning in. Please contact your friends and get them tuned in as well. Until next time, I wish you all a great week of summer-filled days when your voice of the earth will again speak truth to wonder each Thursday and every day on the archives here on the Wild Side News.